This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Monday, October 6, 2014. I'm Caleb Brown. The public airing of certain ideas was once viewed as merely disagreeable. Today, disagreeable expressions are often viewed as offensive or triggering, and thus should be prohibited from public spaces, and in particular, college campuses. Greg Lukianoff from the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education is author of Freedom from Speech. We talked about it last month.
You spend a lot of time talking about disinvitation season in this piece. And first, just describe what that is.
Well, disinvitation season was actually sort of a dark joke that we used to make within FIRE. And it refers to every spring when commencement speakers start getting announced for different colleges across the country, students and faculty will rise up to demand that they get disinvited. And as I said, at first it was sort of a dark joke, but then it seemed like every year it was getting worse and worse. And while FIRE certainly supports students' rights to protest speakers or to disagree with the selection of a speaker, it seemed like the weight was really going in favor of having speakers entirely excluded from campus. And the point I always like to make is that even though we talk about disinvitation season, and again, what the term means is the push to get people disinvited. The fact that they actually are disinvited in some cases is less important. Is that it's not just commencement speakers. I'd say probably around I think more than half of the speakers we've seen disinvited were just coming to give regular old speeches on campus. And the bar really seems to be getting higher and higher for the purity test that you have to pass in order to speak on campus. This past disinvitation season, Ayaan Hirsi Ali was an early disinvitee at Brandeis University. And then Condoleezza Rice was targeted for months and months, and she finally bowed out under pressure, which I would count as a success of the disinvitation movement. They'd be, as far as they're concerned, that's the result they wanted. But then it ended up being Christine Lagarde, the director of the International Monetary Fund, stepped down after being invited to speak at Smith. And then Robert Bergenau, the same thing happened to him another college in Pennsylvania. And it really, when it came to Bergenau, it seemed like Haverford. Sorry, when it came to Bergenau, it seemed like what we were saying was that there's, no matter how good you are on 99% of the topics we're concerned about, if you've done one thing we dislike, we're going to demand you be disinvited. And in this case, it was Bergenau's handling of the Occupy Wall Street protests at Berkeley. You make the point that, yes, if you disagree with someone, then by all means, if you want to protest outside, fine. But we also get back to this very old-fashioned idea of shouldn't you at least try to hear the person you disagree with out? Shouldn't you and this was really driven home by what happened to Ray Kelly at when he tried to speak at Brown last fall. Ray Kelly, he's the guy in charge of the police in New York, and he very controversially, started the stop and frisk program. Certainly civil libertarians oppose this, and I think with good reason. But recognizing this, when he offered to speak at Brown, he set aside an hour for question and answer afterwards. So if you really wanted to stick it to Ray Kelly, they were giving him an opportunity to ask him those questions. But instead, Ray Kelly came to speak at Brown. Students gathered together to shout him down so nobody could hear a word that he was saying, and eventually making the speech pointless. And I think the students who were the most robbed by this were the ones who wanted to ask Ray Kelly those tough questions. So the disinvitation season phenomena was definitely very high profile. But I think it shows that students are increasingly, and in some cases faculty members, have some of the wrong ideas about what free speech means.
So I guess I have less of a problem with that than I do with some of the other trends that we're seeing in higher education, most notably the idea of both trigger warnings and what has come to be called safe spaces.
Right.
The idea that certain things just don't get discussed in what seems to be an ever broadening range of contexts.
Right.
So, and from the perspective of academic freedom, if you're, as you point out, an untenured professor who is asked to prepare a syllabus that is warning students that they might find something supremely objectionable in the reading, that colors how you do your job.
Yeah. Well, I focus a lot on trigger warnings in freedom from speech, and I'm very concerned about them. And the problem is the people were advocating for putting trigger warnings, and there was a student at Rutgers who even advocated for a trigger warning being placed on The Great Gatsby because it has apparently misogyny and violence in it. And now you can sort of have this debate at the level of whether or not trigger warnings are a good thing. And that's a deep philosophical debate. Certainly the people who advocate for them, you know, they'll often invoke people suffering from post-traumatic stress syndrome, saying that we're trying to protect them. Now, of course, the huge swath of categories of speech that they want to be accompanied with trigger warnings at schools like Oberlin, for example, really kind of belie that. They make it's much broader than simply someone who's suffering from post-traumatic stress syndrome from abuse or anything like that. But outside of sort of the philosophical debate around it, as a practical matter, I watch professors get in trouble for what they say on campuses all the time. Students will target professors they don't like for any opinion that they really disagree with. Other faculty members will do that in some cases too, and certainly administrators will. The disaster of mandatory trigger warnings, if they were to really impose these things, is that it becomes a literally impossible expectation. No professor can guess what a student will claim, sincerely or not, has quote unquote triggered them. So if we started imposing trigger warnings, if universities decide to adopt trigger warnings as standard practice on campus, this would be an incredible boon for people who want to shut up professors. It would be incredibly easy to say, you triggered me, but you didn't put it in the syllabus, or you could have triggered someone, you didn't put it in the syllabus, and you didn't warn me beforehand. You're out of a job. And as I was writing this, writing the section on trigger warnings, seven professors wrote an open letter to Inside Higher Education saying, we are already getting calls from angry students and administrators saying the material you covered in, I don't know, like your criminal law class or humanities class was too offensive and should have been accompanied by the trigger warning. So I think that professors should be scared to death of the idea that administrations might actually want to impose this impossible standard.
And it does change the burden dramatically.
Yes.
Between – you know, we all want to treat our fellows with respect, and we want to use manners when we deal with people and understand if they have a difficulty to try to treat them with some respect and just try to understand and accommodate that as people in civil society should want to do. But then to flip that and tell everyone that you are now expected to self-censor in a way that you can't really know in advance necessarily how you're going to affect people, it just – it's frightening.
Yeah. Well, and I mean to me sort of philosophically and from a clinical perspective, one of the most frustrating things about the whole trigger warning movement and this was one of the few articles actually written by a psychological healthcare professional about this was in the Chronicle of Higher Education. And she makes the point that everyone needs to understand is that what you're saying by having a trigger warning is that, well, you have PTSD and you're never going to be able to read literature again. You're always going to be frightened, and we're just going to throw up our hands and try to bubble wrap the world around you. That's not what a psychologist wants for someone who suffers from PTSD. They want them to be able to interact freely and without terror. And the idea that by invoking people with PTSD, you have different advocates pushing for a system that basically gives up on people who suffer from post-traumatic stress syndrome, says it's like you're never going to be okay. And in this great piece in the Chronicle, you know, the doctor points out that the whole goal of treating someone with PTSD is to get it so that they can interact normally in the world. Meanwhile, given the fact that than any of the literature, if you're suffering from trauma, anything potentially can trigger you. It's not that the content of Lolita can trigger you. It's that the color of the cover of Lolita can trigger you. It can be anything. So it is literally an impossible thing for university professors to keep track of.
The range of people who to whom this idea of trigger warnings might be subject mm-hmm. is dramatically expanded. It started with just people who have suffered some profound trauma, but is now expanded to apparently include people who are bothered by something.
Right.
That something that even just a few short years ago would have been considered offensive, perhaps patently offensive, is now something that is viewed as threatening.
Right.
And so this idea of trigger warnings plus safe spaces really seems to be a way around not hearing things you want to hear, as the title here implies.
Right. Yeah. And people are endlessly creative at figuring out ways to shut down speech they dislike. And that's something you learn. You don't have to be a First Amendment lawyer to see this in action, but when you are, you get to see it in action every hour of every day. And the current sort of approach to shutting down speech that people don't like on campuses is this very sort of compassion-based, sometimes frankly excuse to say, well, you know, a nice person wouldn't say that, or someone who is sensitive wouldn't talk about this subject. And it has this very kind of frankly passive-aggressive energy around it. Now, the safe space stuff, like, and of course, you tackle trigger warnings or you criticize safe spaces, and it's really easy to portray anybody who has any opposition to them as monsters, essentially, who are incredibly insensitive. But I think that this is playing a very dangerous game. I take on the word safety, the way it's used these days on campuses, head-on and freedom from speech. And my point is it's very important to keep important words as powerful as they were intended to be. But unfortunately, the word safety on campus for quite some time now has been translated into something much softer, something that basically means feeling perfectly intellectually, physically, and emotionally comfortable. When people ask, like, are you feeling safe on campuses, there's a good chance that really what they're asking for is everything – are you totally fine and unruffled in every single way? That's dangerous. That's the lesson that I think people who sort of water down the meaning of safety in that case should think of is the boy who cried wolf. And the idea of – let's say a student is in actual physical danger and they go to their – go to an administrator, go to a teacher, go to a friend and say, I'm not feeling safe. In normal campus parlance, that probably means it's like, oh, I'm uncomfortable. If you even have to hesitate to figure out, are you in actual danger or are you uncomfortable, that creates some potentially genuinely dangerous ambiguities around a lot of situations that could be very serious or not.
We spoke before for a podcast on your book, Unlearning Liberty, and you talked a little bit about how students felt unpopular opinions could be spoken. And the longer that students are in school, the lower their likelihood of agreeing that they may express their unpopular opinions, and higher than any student, of course, or faculty members who felt that it was very unsafe to express popular opinions, unsafe in a right. in a broad sense, unsafe for their careers, that is. But what can we gather from those opinions as these people leave school and then go out into the world?
Right. Well, in Freedom from Speech, I try to sort of expand the lens beyond campus and say where I think we're headed overall for the state of freedom of speech. One of the major points I'm trying to make is that yes, I focus on free speech issues on college campuses, but I think we're not fully understanding the problem unless we get that as people become more affluent, as countries become more comfortable, as people have more medication to take care of pain and they have greater ability to section themselves off into just little internet echo chambers where everyone agrees with them, That people start to see not just physical comfort but intellectual comfort as a kind of right. And this is poison to intellectual development. So I'm not a particularly pessimistic person by nature. You know, I'm excited about technology. I've got, you know, big Ray Kurzweil fan. I can't wait for the nanites to like to solve so many different problems. But partially in contrast to libertarian optimism that I run into an awful lot, I think that there's a category of things that will get worse, not just as everything else is getting better, but because everything else is getting better. And as we get more comfortable, as we get more affluent, I think it's harder and harder to explain to people that disagreement, offensive speech, being challenged, being shown to be wrong is actually good for you. But if you don't believe in if you don't understand that, why would you believe in freedom of speech? And and my premise in freedom from speech is that we're headed into this weird future. You can see it in Europe. You can see it in every country on the planet. You can even see it in the United States, where increasingly people are not expecting so much freedom of speech. They're expecting to be protected from it.
Greg Lukianoff is president of the Foundation for Individual Rights and Education. You can read more on the value of and challenges to free speech at our website, cato.org.